Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Today's guest on the Mike Wise Show is one of the all-time great coaches in NBA history. He's also an author, a former TV analyst, a two-time cancer survivor, and is number six on the all-time victory list. And he's coming right up. But first, Darlene, do your thing.
The Mike Wise Show is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media. The Mike Wise Show is hosted by a guy who played basketball atrociously for Hawaii Pacific College, which forced him into journalism. And, oh yeah, he wrote about basketball for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and ESPN. He's also a wise ass, and so are many of his guests. Right, Mike?
Yes, Darlene, that is true. Thank you again. Today's guest is a little of both. George Karl has led an incredible basketball life. He played college ball for the great Dean Smith at North Carolina, played in the ABA and the NBA for the Spurs, and went on to coach six NBA teams between 1985 and 2016. And he also coached in the old CBA and the EuroLeague. Welcome, Coach.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate you having me, and let's have a good time with all this.
Well, I should say, early happy birthday. I believe you're turning 69 years young on Monday when this comes out.
Yeah, May 12th, I think it's my birthday. I don't know, there's some famous guys. I forget who all the famous guys born on May 12th, and maybe John F. Kennedy, Yogi Bear, or something like that.
Yeah, but neither, they all had decent lives, but neither one of them had to make Sean Kemp and Gary Payton coexist. That was more important than anything they did.
Well, I've had some great characters. I've also had some great talents. Unfortunately, we've won enough games to survive a long time. And, you know, I always think coaching basketball is, people say, you know, I don't want to say it's not work. But all I know is going to a gym every day is there's always some fun to be had and some connection to be had. So, you know, I was very blessed to be able to go to the gym, which was my office.
I was thinking out loud about how everybody and their mom's got a podcast now. You have one. It's called Truth in Basketball. How has that been?
I actually enjoy it. I was surprised by how much I've actually enjoyed it, because I think on a podcast, you go deeper, you get a little more soulful, you can ask questions and you can swear a little bit, and you can maybe express the passion and the emotions of a story a little bit more. And, you know, I think what's funny is the people that came to me to put this on, you know, one wanted it to be truth in basketball. I kind of like the idea of truth in basketball, because so much of, I think, today's media and interviewing process has a spin or a perception to it, you know, and I think telling the truth is something that I think the game of basketball actually needs. I think everything needs. I think our world needs more transparency, and I think the game of basketball, even though I think it's in a great place, I think honesty is the best policy.
One of the things I loved when I did cover the NBA for the New York Times and later wrote a column for the Washington Post is you were one of the most transparent people. There was no bullshit. There was sort of, if you liked something, you said so. If you didn't like something, you said so. And irrespective of how that made people feel, it was authentic. And we didn't get a lot of authenticity. One of the things I like about the league now is guys are starting to speak their mind, irrespective of where you fall on the political spectrum. I love that guys are putting themselves out there and saying, hey, you're a lousy president, or I think black men getting shot by law enforcement in this way is wrong, and we need to fix this in society. I like that there's kind of a renaissance of social conscience among athletes, and guys aren't just playing it safe so they can protect their endorsements.
I agree with you 100%. I think, especially now, I think we're in a with the pandemic that we're confronting and facing every day. You know, I think crisis creates evolution. I think crisis creates us to think and find answers to not only the pandemic, but some of the changes of our society right now that might have to be in our society for a year or maybe two. And I think the more we get the, I've always felt that the more information you get, the better answer you'll have. You know, I started coaches meetings about 10, 15 years ago. And I really want my assistant coaches to tell me what they think. I don't want them to hold back that if I made a mistake in a strategy or a game, I want them to call me out. And, you know, we can argue, we can fight, but when we leave the room, we're all together, we're a team, and we're unified in what we decide on doing.
I like that, because there's so much, toxic top-down management in this society that doesn't even have to do with the NBA. It's nice that obviously there's one leader, but if that leader can hear from everybody and impart some of their stuff, it's a better environment to work in. Do you there's not much basketball going on. I think you're in Colorado. How has the COVID-19 changed your world at all out there?
Well, you know, I'm 69 years old. I'm a male. I've had cancer two or three times. And so I check all the negative box of probably I should stay hibernating in my house as much as possible. My older kids feel that I shouldn't go out of the house very often. I actually have gotten out and played golf. They opened up the golf courses out here about 10 days ago. And I got out one time, and I'm going out next week some. So I ride a bike. Denver is a big biking city, so my exercise program is riding a bike and inside or outside. And the weather has been great. Denver's a fantastic city. It's of all the cities I've lived, I think this is the one I'm going to pick to hang out with the rest of my life. And just missed the game of basketball. The Nuggets here, the Denver Nuggets, are a good basketball team. I don't know if they're good enough to win a championship, but I wish they would have had an opportunity to maybe grow up and learn about that process. And hopefully they will still have that possibility in the near future.
I love that team. Just because they're successful, and you know, I think Malone's a heck of a coach, and I also think that the players like Jokic. It just makes the game so much easier. I remember when we talked long ago, we were in an environment where kids getting out of school just didn't trust their teammates, and it was just about so much isolation going on, and you know, as anybody's found out the last few years in the league, you move the ball, it makes life easier for everybody. And Jokic is a classic, you know, shoot. He might be one of the best interior passes I've seen since Walton, almost. Just a really fun guy to watch.
He's incredible. Mike, I'm going to tell you, people, you know, because he's in Denver, and Denver gets some national publicity, but he's a top. He's definitely a top 10 passer in the game of basketball, period. And he might be a top 5 passer in the game of basketball. That's how talented he is. He sees the game. You know, he does a lot of point guard things. They run the offense for him probably 75, 80% of the time. And he loves making his team happen. I mean, it's not an ego thing for him to score points. It's an ego thing for him to probably get triple doubles. I mean, he really enjoys the process of passing the ball. His only weakness in my mind is probably his pick and roll defense. And he's gotten better there. He's improving in that area. And they're a good young team searching for a personality of being a championship team.
Well, have you, there's not much hoops going on lately, but The Last Dance is kind of taking the country by storm because it's the only basketball out there. Have you been watching it?
Yeah, I'm a Michael Jordan guy, you know. He's a part of the North Carolina fraternity.
Yep.
He's been a great ambassador, not only for basketball, but for North Carolina. I think the first couple episodes, you know, I enjoyed it because he talks like a Carolina basketball player. You know, we got to be together, and we got to stay connected, and all the things. I think his foundation came from Coach Smith, which is where my foundation came. And I think it's really fun to listen to one of the, you know, in my opinion, the best player to ever play the game, and his roots being from Chapel Hill kind of turns me on and makes me feel excited.
Yeah, I have a confession, because I guess when I really got my job in New York, it was after the Bulls had won their first three. So by the time they played you guys in the championship, which was the finals that year, they had just become like the Beatles. You know, they'd become so big and they were almost imperious. And, you know, it was hard to cover them if you weren't a network partner. And it's sort of like getting close to anybody there was tough. Obviously, Steve Kerr was good and a couple of the other players. But, you know, it just was really hard to get close to anybody there. And Phil was a little aloof. And I want to say, while people wanted to see the Bulls win that title, a lot of the country was rooting for Seattle that first year. And I just the whole thing was like, Jesus, Michael, can't someone beat you? And then when I started watching this Last Dance, man, seeing them get the first taste of it, I really started to like Michael and what he was about. Beyond all the hype, just the competitiveness, the idea of giving yourself to the good of the group, and all the things that Carolina taught him, really.
Well, you know, when I've been blessed to play golf with Michael. He hangs out with some North Carolina, you know, parties that we have. He comes back every once in a while. He doesn't come back all the time, but Michael is very comfortable in who he is, and he's very, you know, he's somewhat confident, which he should be. But, you know, one thing I like about Michael, I think he handles almost any situation. You know, he can walk in, and if it's a blue collar, you know, situation, he'll handle that. If he has to wear a tuxedo, he can handle that. He has a smile on his face. He has a charisma to him. And he had it when he was like 20 years old. He's had that. You know, he might have been naive when he was younger, but I think he's evolved into a really great ambassador of the game. And I'm proud of him being from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Yeah, it doesn't matter who I run into, Michael Coren or Stuart Scott when he was alive, everybody. It was like there's such a UNC brotherhood. It's very unique in the world of basketball. You never see guys running around going, hey, he's a Loyola guy, or he's a Santa Clara guy. He's a Fresno State guy. God bless my alma mater. But Carolina guy, that's a saying. Doesn't matter if it's Larry Brown. Doesn't matter if it's you, Michael Jordan, Sam Perkins. It's just a thing. And why is there such a UNC brotherhood? Why are all the players who played for Dean so devoted to him?
I think it's the reason is we're all loyal to Coach Smith. I mean, Coach Smith, I would say a vast majority of the players that played for Coach Smith look at Coach Smith as their second father. And, you know, he was more than a basketball coach. I speak all the time on leadership. And Coach Smith was a better coach of men than he was of basketball. You know, he kind of always wanted to know what was making you tick and what was important to you. And then he would always bring people into your life that could mentor you in the way that he thought was what you wanted. You know, I had back surgery my freshman year in college, and I got in the film room with Coach Guthridge and Coach Smith a lot in my freshman year. And that was the beginning of my roots of trying to be a coach, you know. And then, you know, after I graduated, he got me to be an assistant coach with Larry Brown on a USA team that went to Russia. And then I learned the game of basketball from a different guy, Larry Brown, who's brilliant and a great coach. But, you know, I got the same wisdom, but with different words and different stories and different explanations. So coaches, and not only, you know, Coach Smith doesn't do this with just basketball. He's as proud of his lawyers and his doctors and his entrepreneurs that have gone on and have had great success. And they're all welcome in the program as alumni of the program. And if you were a starter or if you're a 10th man on the roster, Coach Smith valued you and made you feel important.
You became head coach of the Cavs, I think, at just age 33. That's pretty young to get a job that age. I mean, in the NBA, nowadays they're hiring kids, but back then they didn't do it. How'd you get that gig?
You know, the story I believe is, I don't know if you knew, there was a scout, a player personnel guy by the name of Al Menendez.
Oh, I remember Al Menendez.
Yeah, Al was in New Jersey, and Harry Weltman was looking to hire a personnel guy when I was coaching in Great Falls, Montana. And Harry wanted to hire Al. Al didn't want to leave New Jersey, and Al recommended me. And that got me in the door with Harry Weltman. And they had a team that was kind of plateaued in Cleveland. And I did a year of scouting and college scouting and worked hard. And I think Harry Weltman liked my work ethic. And he saw that. And towards the end of the year, Don Nelson called me up and said, "Hey, George, I want you to come to Milwaukee and be an assistant coach with me in Milwaukee." So I walked in Harry Weltman's office and I said, "Harry, you know," I said, "I appreciate your opportunity to get me in back in the NBA. But I want you to know there's a possibility that Nelly wants me to go with him in Milwaukee. And I want you to know that I want to get back on the floor, that I don't think I want to be in the front office. I think I want to be on the floor." And, you know, Harry said, "I understand. I respect your request, but I want you to know there's a possibility that we could be making a coaching change here. And the ownership thinks that you would be a candidate for the job." And so I was shocked at that. And I called Nelly up and said, "Hey, if I have a chance to be a head coach, I think I want to stay here." And somehow, some way, went through the process. They interviewed three or four guys. I think it came down to me and Dick Carter. And some reason, Gordon Gunn and Harry decided to pull the trigger and give me an opportunity. And I don't even know if you remember at my start. I started out 2-19.
2-19
and made the playoffs.
That's incredible. I would have fired you at 2-19 if I was an owner.
I would say 95% of the city of Cleveland had me fired. But, you know, one of my best years of coaching was we turned it around. We made the playoffs winning, I think, 36 games. And we played the Celtics. We played the Celtics in the first round. And every game we lost in, you know, it was a five-game series. We lost 3-1. But all four games, we had the lead or was tied in the last 2 minutes of every game. And so they were all close games. And, of course, you know, as I learned in my experiences of coaching, close games are usually won by the better team or the more experienced team. And of course the Celtics Celtics won the championship that year. They went on to win the championship.
Yeah. That was one of the best teams of all time. That 85-86 team, Celtics team. That was incredible.
They were very skilled, very, very, very talented, very talented.
Yeah. I once a while back when we spoke a long time ago, I had interviewed you and a bunch of other Chris Webber and Jerry Colangelo. We kind of did a state of the game thing, and I looked it up, and you had a great quote, like one of the great quotes of all time that I remember. And I basically asked you, what would you give advice? What kind of advice would you give a young NBA coach? And your answer was, I don't know why I win basketball games other than I think my players play hard for me. Players know that I care and that I want to win, and it possesses me. It possesses me to where I destroy friendships. But there's a passion to what I do in basketball that my players know. You got to have energy and you got to have the passion and a love for this game to be successful in it. I love that answer. Do you have any regrets about friendships that were destroyed?
My greatest regret is probably my older children. You know, I was possessed to be a really good coach, and every day I woke up, my life was based on coaching and going to work. And I was a little bit too much of a workaholic. And, you know, my older daughter and my oldest son, you know, we've talked about that I might have cheated them some. And, you know, I was a part-time parent, and an MBA coach is on the road and out of the city half the time. And then probably half the other time I was possessed on trying to be as good a coach as I could be. So that's the one regret I had. I've had a couple of bouts with cancer. And after my second cancer, I learned to balance my life a little bit better for 4 or 5 years that I coached after my second cancer. And I wish I had learned that earlier in life, that I would have given more time to the people who were supporting me, the people who loved me. And of course, we grew up to have my family. I'm blessed to have a really still strong, connected family. But I think I cheated them somewhere along the way.
Well, and I'm an old dad. I'm 56, but I feel like I'm emotionally about 20. I've got a 9-year-old boy, 5-year-old boy, and a 2-year-old daughter. I understand you've got a teenage daughter now.
Yeah, I started a second family, and I have a daughter that's 15 years old.
So she's probably getting tons of time with you.
I'm sorry?
She's probably getting to spend tons of time with you.
Yeah, and there's much more. I think there's no question that I now understand why teenagers drive people crazy, because she is driving me absolutely crazy. She is stubborn, opinionated. She's into women's rights. So anytime I have a bias towards women, I get yelled at. She's very bright. She goes, you know, she's trying to be she actually wants to go to Columbia University right now. That's her goal. Her goal is her goal would probably be to get a scholarship in soccer, a good soccer program. And I want you to I don't think she'll be able to ever hear this podcast, but
yep.
Watching soccer, I cannot handle. It's a very, very boring sport. My daughter plays center back, which is a defender.
Yeah.
And it's she's like a relief pitcher. When she does her job, she gets no appreciation. If she makes a mistake, it can cost the game. Oh. And other than the goaltender, center backs are the ones that got to make good reads and good decisions and keep the defense together. But when you're threatened, you got to make good plays and good decisions. But
yeah, they're like linemen. They're like kickers. You only notice when they screw up.
Exactly. And you know, she loves soccer, but you know what? She also plays basketball. She played a lot of minutes as a sophomore this year on her varsity team here in Denver. It's not a great team, but I think she actually fell a little bit in love with basketball this past year. So I'm hoping that might go a little bit further, but I don't know if she has enough time to make up for all the time she spent on kicking a ball around in the backyard. But it's fun being around teenagers, because today's world is a little bit different than my kids grew up in the 80s and the 90s. And,
yeah.
And today's world is quite different than the 80s and the 90s.
Oh, just a little. Jesus. I mean, we didn't even have I didn't even have a cell phone growing up, until I got older. Do you, Kobe has turned into a pretty decent coach. He's coaching the Lakers G League team, isn't he?
Kobe's better than decent. I think he's going to be really good. I think he and I, we talk quite frequently about coaching. And Kobe's other mentor in his life is Phil Jackson. And last summer, Phil Jackson and I and Kobe went out to his house in Montana and spent 3 or 4 days together. And it was really fun. I mean, Kobe had to talk me into doing it. And, you know, Phil has probably kicked my ass more than any coach in basketball. And I'm going, okay, why? And then I walk into his house and he has all these trophies. And he has all these windows of teams that he beat. He put me in the bedroom where it was the Seattle Supersonic window. there was a lot of subconscious, subliminal commentary going on quite frequently in our talks. But I got to know Phil pretty well, and what's funny, you know, in a strange way, Phil and I are probably a lot alike. But he does it with a Zen mentality, and I do it like a general mentality. So, you know, I'm more into controlled chaos, and I think Phil's more into calm and mellow.
Did you go fishing with him? What'd you do? Did you share some ganja? What would you do?
You know, we took he lives in a beautiful area, so we drove around Whitefish and Kalispell, and
yep.
I spent three. He grew up in Great Falls, Montana, and I spent 3 years in Great Falls, Montana. And you know, and then we'd wake up in the morning and talk some basketball, and go to lunch, and we come back and talk basketball, or take a tour of the city, or just go out and enjoy nature. We took a bike ride, I think, one time, and then at nighttime. Phil loves to watch movies. I mean, he loves to watch movies. So I think one or two nights we watched a movie. It was just a kind of a fun thing. And I think Kobe, you know, Kobe is very much into trying to evolve and learn. And Phil and I are quite different offensively and actually quite different probably defensively. But I think it's good to, I think, again, sitting in meetings where the most information and why you did things, I think, helps young coaches evolve and develop their own personalities.
That's great that he's getting the sort of – he's a mixture of the Zen and the general. When he gets an NBA head coaching job, he's obviously promised you a job on his staff already, hasn't he?
We've talked about it. I mean, I go out to LA.
Love it.
I think he's going to probably have to learn how to tell me to shut the fuck up. But I think he's getting strong enough to do that now.
he would probably almost bring you onto his staff just so he could tell you shut the fuck up. Basically, that would be part of the job.
Yeah. That would be fine with me. I think I could be an assistant coach and learn to shut the fuck up a little bit.
Selfish question here, because I have a 9-year-old. He's a pretty good player. He thinks he's going to play at Carolina, but with my genes, he won't get past Division III. But nonetheless, when Kobe was growing up, did you encourage? Did you push him too hard? Have you had any advice for a dad whose son loves the game and he wants him to take it as far as he can, but he didn't want him to, you know, he don't want to burn him out? What would you say?
I fell in love with Kobe being with me in the gym. I mean, I wanted Kobe to come to every practice. I wanted him to come to every coach's meeting. In fact, we just, you know, on my podcast, Kobe, I think it was released this week, I did a 2-part podcast with Kobe. And we talk about exactly what you're saying. We talk about how, see, Kobe wasn't very big. Kobe was 6'1", 150 pounds at the beginning of his senior year. Now, he grew to about 6'3", and maybe 165 pounds his senior year. But he was a walk-on at Boise State. And he redshirted his first year and went into the weight room. And I think, I don't know if you've seen Kobe lately, but Kobe's 6'5", 210 pounds now.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had that late spurt. And he always had the little things of basketball. He was a passer. He liked passing. And he was always a good to great shooter. But he liked the game, and he was around Rick Majerus and Don Nelson and Larry Brown and Doug Moe, and he was always in our coaches meeting with Tim Gergeridge and John Welsh and just really great assistant coaches. And, you know, for many years I was saying he probably's not listening very well, but he listened well, and now I think he's used a lot of that information. But I think what I loved about Kobe was he was kind of a gift, because I loved him being with me. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't a great high school player, but he became a damn good college player. And then when he made the Lakers, I remember the year he made the Lakers, Mitch Kupchak, who's one of my good friends, mm-hmm. calls me and tells me that Kobe made the Lakers. And I just go off and say, Mitch, that's great. Thank you very much. I appreciate you taking care of my son. And Mitch yells at me. He said, George, you know, Kobe made this team. This is not a gift. Kobe earned this team.
Oh, that must have been.
That meant a lot to me. And
I would have cried. Again, I would have broke up crying on the phone if someone said that about my son. That's amazing.
And, you know, he didn't get to play much. And, you know, Kobe and I have actually talked that if he would have made another team and gotten more opportunities to play, he might have had an NBA career. But, you know, he had a good European career. He played in Europe many years and made a hunk of money. And, you know, now I just, you know, he's at South Bay Lakers, and he has a great relationship with the Buss family. I think he had a really good relationship. He basically started his relationship with Luke Walton. But I still think, you know, I don't know how long he'll stay with the Lakers. But he enjoys being a head coach. And we've talked about maybe it's time for him to get behind the bench or sit on the bench in the NBA. But, you know, he has a passion for the game, and it's fun to live. It's kind of now fun for me to live basketball through him a little bit.
Yeah. I think it's amazing, and that might be the favorite part of our podcast right there. I love that story of Mitch yelling at you and saying, "No, he made this team. Like he didn't get a gift from another Carolina guy. He made this." I think that's just awesome. I was looking at some of your accomplishments. I don't want to blow smoke because you know what they are. I mean, you're sixth on the all-time regular season wins list, sixth in total regular season NBA games coached. Boy, that number six keeps coming up. Six in playoff games coached, and you've been head coach of six NBA teams. And you have a 666 on your forehead, which you – no, I'm kidding. But the bottom line is I looked at all these numbers, and I just remember covering the 95-96 finals. I thought to myself, like, do you ever think about the Hall of Fame? Is it something in your head that you think it'd be great or even – is it, does it own a speck of real estate in your head?
Do I think about it? I think, you know, once a summer, we'll all with my family, when we get together, I think my kids want me to make the Hall of Fame. And yeah, I think about it. But in the same sense, I'm humbled by, you know, my career. I mean, you know, I started out 2-19, and I could have been very easily got fired. I was in Madrid, Spain, and coaching Real Madrid. And why did Bob Woodson call me? I still don't know exactly why that happened. And I got back with a team in Seattle that, you know, the team just fit my personality. They needed a passionate guy that, you know, taught the game the right way. And I had great assistant coaches with Tim Gergeridge and Bob Kloppenberger, Terry Stotts and Dwayne Casey would come later. And so, you know, we just had a great run in Seattle. And Gary and Sean were young players that were searching for a direction. And once they found that direction, they were fantastic.
Oh.
And, you know, I mean, and you know, the 7 years in Seattle, we never won a championship, but That's a pretty good run out there for a team that never won a championship.
Oh, I mean, you average more than 59 wins a season. It was amazing. And what kills me about it, I mean, what I loved and what I feel is selfishly your greatest moment was you're down 0-3 against the Bulls. Me and Frank Isola, New York, all the New York writers, everybody in town actually that loves Seattle as a city is going, ah, crap, these bastards are going to get swept and we're going to have to leave and go home early. We wanted at least a week here at the finals. And all of a sudden you win the next two games and you send the series back to Chicago. And all of a sudden the riders are taking ferries out to Bainbridge Island, renting bikes. We're loving you at that point, George.
Well, Seattle in the springtime and early summer is probably as pretty as it gets. And, you know, I've actually gone back and looked at all those games in this pandemic situation. And it was two really good defensive teams, and they were just
– yeah.
We couldn't score. Come game six, we couldn't score.
Yeah.
I mean, we won the two games in Seattle because our defense created enough offense to get over the hump. I think we scored over 101 time and only in the 90s, like three times. And so, you know, we were in the 80s and maybe the last game might've been in the 70s. And I was watching that game and I saw what a difference, you know, taking hands off of guards is and the freedom of movement and flow. I mean, that was a wrestling match more than in today's game. It's more of a track meet, and that series was more of a wrestling match, and a lot of physicality, a lot of toughness, mental and physical toughness, and you know, I actually thought we did a good job with Michael most of the series. Guys like Rodman and Kukoc and Pippen were the guys we lost the series.
Yeah, there was a heck of a supporting cast in that. One of the great stories when Jamal Crawford gave us a good hour recently, he said, you know, I said, what were you doing tonight? And he goes, oh, I was working the concessions, helping my sister. And I was just sitting on the stairs watching. And I was going, wow, that was a long time ago. But, you know, he almost got emotional talking about losing basketball in Seattle. What was that like for you?
I'm still pissed off about it. You know,
Wow.
I have no idea. You know, it was like there was something about David Stern and his relationship with the city, not the team of Seattle, but the government of the city of Seattle and the government of the state of Washington. I just don't think I don't think David enjoyed the relationship. And Howard Schultz, I have no idea what happened there. I was actually in. My daughter lives in Olympia now, and I was visiting her the day they announced announced that they were moving to Oklahoma City. And I was driving my car. I had to pull off to the side of the road and just think about it. And I'll be honest with you, it still angers me today that the city of Seattle doesn't have basketball. I mean, it's just kind of – I think it'll get back someday. I hope it gets back in my time, but –
so you pull over the side of the road, you're basically getting emotional about it.
Well, you know, I had an AAU team in Seattle called Friends of Hoop.
Mm.
It's still in Seattle. I don't have anything to do with it anymore. But Sam Perkins and I started a Martin Luther King High School basketball tournament when we were there. There's a lot of roots in Seattle that are really important to me, and a lot of guys still live there. You know, I know Gary goes back a lot. Sean and Detlef live there.
Yeah.
And Nate McMillan is one of my favorite people of all time. And I mean, it was just a great 7 years.
Yeah. Before we move past the Seattle experience, Sam Perkins told us a story at All-Star Weekend about a time that you borrowed his clothes for a game. I have to let you hear this because I didn't believe it. I did not believe it myself.
So he comes out with my sweater on, my mock neck that he stretched to to oblivious. I did not know. First of all, I kept looking at him like, he don't wear the mock necks. So I ain't paying no mind. I don't even know if we won the game. But the point when we got back to the locker room, he takes the damn thing off and he says, Perk, this is yours. He took somebody else's belt and said, this is yours. He had somebody's jacket and said, I can't even remember. But all I remember is my stretch mock. My neck, my half neck turtleneck was stretched to oblivion because his big head went all through it, and then his neck was bigger than mine. And I was like, no, you didn't. And you know how coaches sweat profusely. This thing was ringing. I could not wear it.
True story. It is a true story. There were days in my life, I think I must have took a sweater that had a hole in it or something like that, and I walked around the locker room trying to find something I could put on, and it was Sam's. In fact, I think Sam gave it to me. He didn't take it back.
Well, he said you stretched the hell out of it, and then he said you wore a teammate's belt and another guy's coat. I love that. You borrowed an outfit.
Yep, I did. I did that on one game, and I remember one game in Denver. I wore an Iverson jersey into the game because I forgot something else. I wore a jersey, got fined like $10,000. So
oh, that's great.
Try to connect with players in any way possible.
Yeah. I mean, I think of the ABA. I always liked your offbeat sense of humor. There must have been some craziest ABA story you could think of, like that really stuck out in your mind.
Well, what's funny is ABA. I think the way the game is played now is kind of where the game was played in the early ABA. Mm. Well, when the ABA was getting good.
Yeah.
I mean. There was more freedom of movement. Our big guys are more shooters than post-up guys. Even though we had some good big guys, but we had Dan Issel was a great shooter. We had other guys that were 6'9", 6'10", that were shooting three-pointers back then. And, I mean, the way the freedom of movement and flow, that there was more of that in the ABA game than the NBA game. Yeah. And I wish they would. One thing about the ABA that I've talked about is I wish they would – I don't understand why the red, white, and blue ball doesn't come back into the game. I just think it was a good part of the game. I know the NBA didn't want anything to do with it when we merged, but aren't we over that now? Can't we get to the point of maybe – I actually think, every team you play, the ball could be the team colors of the team you play. Like you go in the
– Oh, yeah.
You go into Boston, it'll be green and white. And when you go into Cleveland, it'll be orange and white. I mean, you could make it a kind of a fun thing for, I think, the fan, and also it'd probably be a moneymaker for the league.
Oh, it's a marketing. It's a marketing genius. I don't know why they came up with that stupid rubber ball that wasn't even leather for a while. That's a great idea. God darn it. A few more before I let you go. On April Fool's Day in 2014, you named your top three rappers on NBA Tonight, and the internet exploded. I just have to ask, are you still a Gucci Mane fan?
You know something? I've actually listened to Gucci Mane a couple times, and my son is a big rap person. I forget the guy that he has on his radio all the time. It's a rapper that doesn't swear very much, and he talks about community service. And what I've learned through rap is this is poetry. This is old school. This is street hood, in the hood poetry. I learned to respect it a lot. But it was a hell of an April Fool's joke, and it was funny how many people thought I really was into that. But I'm probably not very much into it at all.
The other one, I look back this everything on the internet now, it blows up like crazy. And but they had this thing last week, like people were saying that Carmelo Anthony was a better player than Paul Pierce. I just, you know, you coached him. Like, what were your thoughts? I couldn't digest it, not just because of Paul Pierce's accomplishments, but, you know, Melo, I like him. I just never thought he gave himself to the good of the group enough. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, I think Melo was the most talented offensive player I've ever coached. Wow, I coached Paul Pierce in the USA team, and Paul was very talented offensively. But I think Paul was much more into being a playmaker, as where Melo, you had to force him to be a playmaker, and he had to be convinced that he had trouble trusting his teammates in big-time situations. Yeah. And, he wanted the spotlight probably a little bit too much. When we made the trade for Chauncey, I think Chauncey really helped him understand to be a champion, you had to sacrifice a little bit of who you were. And, I've always rooted for Melo to figure it out, to be able to figure it out and come back and play a team game and understand that the game of basketball will give you the points. You just don't have to force it. I don't think Melo ever trusted that the game would give him what happened. If he had played the game the right way, the game would come to him. I thought he was doing a good job in Portland this year. Yeah. I actually think he at times looked like he had figured out that he was, you know, the third or fourth fiddle in the band, and that you can't force the game and you can't make bad decisions. And the game was coming to him pretty well. At times he played very, very well, I think, this year.
Yeah, I agree. It's weird how the game comes to some people later. It's just too bad that he didn't realize that earlier in his career, because he had all the gifts. You're right. You had Allen Iverson in Denver for parts of three seasons. Memories of AI.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing that body, that small of a player, could be as dominant as he was. I think I was getting him towards the end of his career, where he didn't have that flashy speed and quickness. I think he was wearing out a little bit. He didn't want to go to the rim as much as he used to do. He used to go to the rim. And I really actually enjoyed AI off the court. You know, AI has this image that he's this, you know, crazy guy. AI is really pretty down to earth, and I think has some family values. And I know that those things never came out in his personality, but I think, you know, going out and practice things and not, and, you know, the one thing I didn't disturb me, but I realized very early, I think AI was nocturnal. I think he wanted to sleep during the day and go out at night. And to overcome all those things, that the size and the ability of how hard he played and how he got knocked around, to play at that level, an all-star level, and go to an NBA final level, in that small body frame. Well, I mean, he'll be one of the greatest little guys of all time playing this game.
Oh, to me, like Isaiah Thomas, him, a couple others. You're right. I feel like, I don't know how he moved the little body through all those mounds of muscle and got to the rim so often at that size. But yeah, you're right. It was amazing to watch. All right, I'm going to let you go on this. You know, in Denver, you had 8-plus seasons of success, and you did a lot of stuff. But, you know, in 2005, you were diagnosed with prostate cancer. And then 2010, you talked about early diagnosed with throat and neck cancer. You beat this twice. How are you feeling these days? I mean, you sound good. And I love that you're staying in, but you feeling okay?
Yeah, I weigh 228 pounds today, and when I was coaching the NBA, I weighed between 260 and 280. I exercise. I got my eating habits under control. I don't drink as many beers as I used to. I'm hoping to hang around to see all my grandkids, maybe get married, and also walk my 15-year-old daughter down the aisle someday. So I'm doing well. You know, I'm blessed to have enough money in the bank that I can support my family. And I would love to get back in the game in some form or some habit of helping somebody. But if I don't, I'm not gonna regret it, because I never thought I would coach. I coached 1,999 games.
Yeah.
When I was 2-19 in Cleveland, I thought I was going to coach like 40. So
that is amazing. That, talk about, when I think of Survivor in the NBA, I think of you, sir. And it's just one, it's been a pleasure to know you for many years and cover your games. But two, it's been even better to hear you grow personally as a guy that really, you know, went through hell and came back to realize some of heaven in his life. That to me is a big testament to who you are, more than the fact that you know a shitload more about basketball than I ever will. So thank you.
Well, Michael, thank you. It's good catching up with you. And hopefully the podcast, you and Bruce, can get this thing going in a great direction.
Yeah. Well, and I look forward. And if Kobe ever does get a head job, which I believe he will, I think he should ceremoniously make you the head coach for one game so you get to 2,000, damn it.
You know, what's funny is if I coached 2,011 games, I probably wouldn't remember it, but I always remember I've coached 1,999.
There's something to be said for stuck on that, yeah. All right. Stay well, stay healthy, and I look forward to seeing you in person at some point when all this clears.
Sounds good, guys. Thanks, Bruce. Thanks, Mike.
All right, let's go. Time to stick the landing.
Thanks to George Karl for spending some time with us this week. If we played 6 degrees of George Karl, we could get all the way to Dr. James Naismith in 3 moves. George played for Dean Smith, who played for Kansas coach Fog Allen, who learned the game from Dr. Naismith. Boom! Thanks to my producer, Bruce Bernstein. If we played 6 degrees of Bruce, we could spend years trying and still get nowhere. Our editor, Ben Wolfen, always gets it done for us. Thank you, Ben. Please check out our other Pure Hoops Media shows. Full Court Press with Fanta and Adams drops a new show every Tuesday. Catch and Shoot 2.0 with Otto and Aaron has a new show every Wednesday. And Monica McNutt has a fresh Buckets, Boards, and Blocks each Thursday. BJ Armstrong, Eric Newman, you know them. They have the Pure Hoops podcast each Friday. And I'm back with a new Mike Wise show every Monday. Please listen, download, rate, and review us. And most of all, yes, enjoy. As we keep battling this coronavirus pandemic, please remember the bravery of our doctors, nurses, hospital workers, and all the other support staff helping out the sick and the healthy. When you hit the grocery store, for example, let the workers know you appreciate them keeping the food on our table. Please don't drink bleach, Drano, hand sanitizer, or any other cleaning products. I'm not a doctor, but trust me on this one. Hope you and your family and friends are healthy and safe, and I'll see you next week. Peace.
The Mike Wise Show used to be called The Wise Ass Show, but it remains a presentation of Pure Hoops Media.